Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening. October 18th, 2007. And tonight I'm going to wrap up the weaponization of outer space. I'm going to make a few closing comments on that. And there are so many other topics that have to be covered. I was going to do a four-part series, four shows on that topic. But I think if you listen to the past two weeks' shows, you will get the idea. You're going to understand what's going on with this entire topic of weaponization of outer space. What's involved? Who are the players? Why is it happening? And, who's making money off this? This is always what you follow. As they say, follow the money trail, and you will find out who exactly is involved in what's really making this industry tick, so to speak. And it is an industry. You oftentimes think that the military commanders, etc., are independent and they just think what's best for you and what's best for the country. But I really found that that's not the case. There's a lot of egos involved. There are people that don't really look at the job of defending the country in terms of strictly that. They look in terms of toys. In other words, this is their thing. They feel important if they're getting a lot of funding and getting their military toys. And as I said last week, when these agencies, the military agencies and the supporting aerospace industries and other industries that support the war industry, then when these become autonomous and they see their existence as a primary importance, then you have a problem. And that's, of course, with the Eisenhower warning that occurred during his final farewell speech back in the early 50s. Beware of the military-industrial complex. Well, he already knew about that. I mean, he knew about it, and it's rather odd that he would mention that because he was very much a part of it. But sometimes people say things, and I always found that curious, that there was no one that was more part of the military-industrial complex than Eisenhower. Then in his farewell speech to warn us against it I just find it curious. But at any rate, listen to the last couple weeks' shows, and I'll leave with one parting thought, that subject, the subject of weaponization in outer space. And that is that I don't think that the American public, first of all, will be given a chance to intervene. And second of all, it has gone underground so far that I don't think they could intervene if they wanted to. But too many people are glued to the Sunday afternoon football frenzy TV, and too many people are involved in other daily activity, which is good. That's what we should be doing. We should be involved with our families and friends. That's great. It's really unfortunate that on an ongoing basis, the public has to continually put out this effort to control its government, which is out of control. But at any rate, that's a whole different topic. The entire issue of weaponization of outer space, the ongoing Cold War with China, Korea, whoever you want, Iran is now being claimed to be a space candidate. Whoever you want to have as your laundry list of bad guys, you can certainly do that. But the end result is that space is a very different arena. And even a small-time player can do a lot of damage because our aging satellite fleet, some of it is new, but a lot of it aging, but that's almost irrelevant because with by very simple means, you can put very, very devastating weapons in outer space that would do in our satellite system. So, as I talked about last week, how China developed a rocket, not a rocket system, but basically a anti-satellite system that would take out easily our satellite, our existing satellite fleet by mechanical means. You simply send a barrage of junk, space junk, pebbles, particles, BBs, whatever you want, into the zone where the satellite that you want to kill is located, and sayonara. There's nothing you're going to do to stop that, except to try and limit those countries from being in outer space. Let me actually close with the following statement. The United States' dependency on satellites is very bad military policy. And for the very simple reason is because they are very vulnerable and we put far too much emphasis and importance and support for our military services on those satellites. Without those few items that might be called our Achilles heel or putting all your eggs in a couple baskets, we really don't have the capability for secondary redundant support on Earth. And if we did, we wouldn't need those satellites in the first place. Because all of the issues that we deal with, GPS, locating devices, etc., all that can be done from the ground, in fact, with the technologies that are available today. So why do we have satellites where all of our dependency is placed on those satellites? And this this inertia to go into outer space with weapons. I want to bring up one slight point here, and that is Benjamin Franklin, when this country was first being founded, had the concept that we should have archers as the standing army. And if you look at the condition, the development of firearms with powder and explosives at the time, that would have been a very good choice because archery was a well-developed military equipment. It would work in the rain. It was well proven. Remember Agincourt back in the 1400s where the English defeated over 10,000 French knights were killed in an early morning battle in the rain, in a pouring rain, with archery equipment. And so that would have been a good choice, but Benjamin Franklin was outvoted. He was overruled. And the standing army, the new militia of the United States, was then supported with gunpowder, with guns, etc., even though it was a far inferior technology. And right now we're dealing with the same thing where they're putting the dependency on outer space technology. And even if it improves, even if the capability, the radio communications, the exact nature of pinpointing cruise missiles or positioning military forces, etc., even if that type of communication were to improve, those satellites will still be extremely vulnerable. And by very primitive means, they are very vulnerable. By very primitive anti-satellite mechanisms, those systems are very vulnerable, and we put far too much emphasis on them. And as I said before, any military commander knows that in a military situation, ultimately, after the first wave, the first barrage, whatever that is, whether you have cruise missiles, even if you have nuclear bombs, whatever happens, you will end up with ground forces one-on-one, man-to-man on the ground. All your satellite communications, all of that is for naught at that point because a hand knife or a small hand weapon is as good as the best highly developed machine gun at close range. So once you get into that scenario, which, as I said before, is the case in Iraq, and in most of the fighting we did in the past 50 years, the case was the same. All your advanced technology you can throw out the window when it comes down to the actual final ground forces entering a region, because there it's one-on-one, man-on-man, and very primitive weapons can change an advantage, which we're seeing also in Iraq. So weaponization of outer space, highly, highly overrated by our military command, very much sought after by our aerospace military industries because of all the money involved. Okay, so money, money, money. That's the last thing I'm going to say about weaponization of outer space. Now, at long last, I promised actually quite a few months ago to upgrade my web page and the sales page. And so due to other activities that I've been involved in, ongoing issues that just consume my time, I haven't had a chance to do that, but it is now in place. I wanted to make sure it was in place before this show aired. And now, so please go to the web page, click on the sales order page, and you're going to see a very new, very condensed, very orderly display of my books, videos, DVDs. Actually, there are no more videos, per se. There are no more VHS tapes. They are all remastered onto DVDs. Excellent job of remastering these. So anyway, let me quick talk about the books, the videos. You call them videos, but really they're DVDs. They were originally filmed as videos in video format, some of them in the studios of various conditions, some at talks I gave at international conferences, etc. And so they were literally on video or super video, beta, whatever the technology was at the time. Now they are all converted onto DVD and will play in either your computer or on your DVD player. And I think most people have those now. So at any rate, let me give a quick summary of the items that I have produced, books, DVDs, lectures, and so on. And this is primarily, a lot of people are familiar with my work, and they're I'll try and keep this as brief as possible, but a lot of people out there really are not fully aware of all of the work that I produced over my career, which goes back to the 1970s. And this is something, now when I put out a book, when I put out a DVD, when I choose videos from my past lectures, of which I have dozens and dozens and dozens of these, I only picked eight, and these are what I call the historically significant videos on DVD. And the books that I put out are put out for a reason. They give you a quantum piece of knowledge. They set a direction. They cover a topic or group of topics. And these are designed to inform you and to direct your thoughts. And one thing that you will find whenever you read my books, whenever if somebody recommends you read my books, a lot of people think, well, that's just another science book or something. These books will change the way you view the world around you. They talk about space science. They talk about the electrical nature of the solar system. These are items which I discovered and printed. The early papers that I published back in the late 70s, early 1980s are included in the books. So there's a lot of historical development. You're going to see who I am, why I did what I did, and why I've been on the cutting edge of science and technology. Even today, you go to any international scientific meeting, they are just starting to ask the questions that I had already asked and answered decades ago. So when you read this information, it is written for the general public. The videos were given, some of them, in front of the general public. So when you see these, you are going to see sometimes me as a younger person, certainly you're going to see information that's going to change the way you view the world, and you're going to realize that the universe, the solar system, the cosmos, and our planet are very alive and very different than what you have seen in standard science. You're going to learn that the history of the world and the human race is very different than what you've been taught. And I quote very great authors, who some of whom have been very much ridiculed throughout their careers, and even some of them after they died, still ridiculed by standard science. But when you go to international meetings today, you will find that every topic that I talk about, the electrical conditions in the solar system, electrical conditions of weather, electrical driving forces, etc., you will find that every meeting topic at these international scientific conventions of the world's leading PhDs in meteorology and sun solar conditions, etc., they're talking about everything that I did and discovered decades ago. And they're just starting to crack the egg and start to look into it. And what's odd, though, is they're still trying to mix this with their outdated, antiquated theories. So it's a very strange operation to watch science today try and develop through having the albatross around its neck of all of this archaic, outdated theory. And you'll learn about this in the books, in the DVDs, in the old videos converted to DVD format. So let me quickly go through the list of books. And once again, the web page, I'll give this out again, is seven letters, www. Dot, and the seven letters are jmccsci.com. That's short for jmccanniscience.com. But too many people misspell that, or they get a letter wrong, so I have an abbreviated version to make it much easier to get to my webpage, jmccsci.com. That's jmcc. S is in Sam, C is in Charlie, I is in Indigo.com. And then just scroll down, you'll find the link to the secure web ordering page. And by the way, measured my web page has about 2.9 gigabytes of information. Now, I don't know of many websites where you'll go and get that amount and level of information. So you can spend some serious amount of time there. Listen to the past radio shows. They're all archived there. Years and years of my radio shows are archived there. And also there's a little column called Thought of the Day. There's another one called Peer Review. It's Criticisms of Peer Review, the process whereby journal articles are reviewed today in the scientific world. But at any rate, you can read those and go back many years and read the thoughts, daily thoughts that I had on certain topics. But anyway, the books, I'm going to just quickly list these. Books in order in which they were produced, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes. It talks about the electrical nature of the solar system. And it gives you a real introduction to the scientific world, how it works, what makes it tick, and what makes it so strange, and what makes it so boring when you listen to standard science. The next is a 60-page pamphlet called Surviving Planet X Passage, and it's a collage of supporting information for the first book. It also gives a very interesting archaeological examination of building a calendar from a pile of rocks. And now we find these rock calendars all over the world, especially a lot of them in the American Southwest. And people in a survival mode had to build a calendar. And this shows you how to do it from a pile of rocks. In a single afternoon, you can build an entire annual calendar from a pile of rocks in an afternoon and evening when the stars come out. And a lot of times in a survival mode, that's all the time you have to do something like that. And it also answers a lot of frequently asked questions. The next book is called Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, and it really is a collage of topics from ancient science to the advancements by Nikola Tesla. And then it brings in a book called The Colburn Connection. And by the way, whenever I mention the Colburn, I have to mention that's spelled K-O-L-B-R-I-N, The Colburn. There is only one legitimate source for that book, and it is the ChaldeanTrust.org. It's www.ChaldeanTrust.org. There are some imitation imposters on the internet, and that's all they are. They're disinformation. You simply do not want those. So the only legitimate source of the Colburn is www.ChaldeanTrust.org. And it's a beautiful big book, richly bound, and it's a series of texts that came from ancient, basically the uncle of Christ, Joseph of Arimathea. It came from his personal library, a whole series of books. And I was the first one to receive one of these books in the United States many years ago, one of three that were brought into the country by a group that kept these books. And they gave it to me for my research. So the book Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, brings in all of these topics and expands on the concept of Planet X and all of the disinformation about Planet X. What is really going on out there? What happened to Atlantis? Who was Tesla? Where did he get his information for his tremendous inventions? What was he doing? He was actually extracting energy from the atmosphere, and this book talks about how you do that. The next book is called, and by the way, as I mentioned, all of these books are written for the general public. Okay, so I'll quickly go through the rest of these. The next book we call the weather book. It's called Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun-Earth Weather. It may sound like a very abominable title, but it's actually very easily read by the average person. We simply call it the weather book. And then the last book is my most recent book, Calculate Primes. It includes a three-hour lecture DVD in the front cover showing a simple process for calculating prime numbers. And a lot of people may say, well, what does that have to do with me? Well, actually, prime numbers are used as the basis of encryption, or at least up until this book came out. And this book shows my theoretical work on the calculation of prime numbers. And it gives the solution to a 2,500-year-old mathematical problem. So, but it is once again written for the general public, and you will understand prime numbers, the basis of all our number systems, all theory, all theoretical work are based on prime numbers. So it's an excellent book, and especially for students anywhere from grade school up to PhD level, and professors, all are reading this book, and they're very amazed at what this book talks about. Oh, then quickly, there's a two DVD set which contain 8 professionally remastered historical record videos. This includes my 1986 invited lecture to Los Alamos National Laboratory, where I gave a talk on my scientific work, and attended were 50 of the world's top plasma physicists. Due to the fact that the room we had reserved there was too small, we had to move to a new room. The original film, the original talk was not filmed, but then we created a reenactment of this, and then that is what you have on the film, on the video. So that is there. And the name of that talk was "Are Comets Really Dirty Snowballs?" And you will see me there as a much younger person, obviously over 20 years ago. Then the other remastered videos include the 1991 professionally produced video called Astronomy for the 90s, an analysis of astronomy back in the 90s, and it is as valid today as it was then. It was actually done as part of a textbook study for the major textbook suppliers of astronomy textbooks. That's when I was teaching astronomy at the university level back in 1990, 91, that era. The next video on this two DVD set is the 2002 Global Wings Conference lecture. I was an invited speaker. This was held in Denver, Colorado. And then the next video is the workshop. It was a four-hour workshop at that in the evening after my talk, dealing with Planet X. So it's an excellent, excellent video, which I'm sure you're going to want to see. There's a bonus video of a cable TV presentation, a one-hour presentation that has aired over the country on cable TV that was made back in the early 2000s era, where I give a lecture. Then there's the 2003 UFO Congress lecture, Planet X and the Historical Development of My Theoretical Work. That is on there. Then the 2004 UFO Congress lecture, Electric Highways to the Stars, where I talk about the electrical propulsion systems that we should be using for space travel. Then there is a third DVD, which contains the first of my 20 DVD lecture series. The topic of DVD number 3, it's a three-hour lecture called Rewriting the Basic Structure of Science from the Subatomic World to Cosmology, and it sets the stage for the upcoming future DVDs lecture series, of which there will be 20 total, where I discuss and go into much more detail on my theoretical work. All of those available on my webpage, plus some other items like posters that deal with my scientific work, the 2005 radio shows on an MP3 disc. That was before I was producing the shows in MP3 format. Now you can listen to all of my radio shows free on my webpage in MP3 format. But so you'll find some other items there on the webpage. Once again, that's JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com, seven letters, JMCCSCI.com. Just scroll down and go to the secure web ordering page, and you'll find all that. The covers, the table of contents, the back page are all visible there, so you can see them and read, get a good introduction to what these books are about. And they're also sold in packages, so you can save quite a bit by buying these in packages. If you are interested in understanding the world around you and the universe around you in a way that makes sense, a way that brings man's history up to date, and the theoretical work that really explains our history, then these books are for you. Okay, so the main science topic tonight I'm going to talk about is the barrage of bad science that's coming out today. But also, I'm going to, you know, it's one thing to complain about bad science, but I'm going to put good science in place of bad science. And I just am amazed, truly, utterly amazed and flabbergasted by some of the absolutely ridiculous ploys that are put out in front of the public in the name of science. I'm amazed and truly my jaw simply drops to the floor when I hear things like this. And these are published in scientific journals. I just, for example, this past week, scientists claimed all of a sudden that Venus, our inner neighbor, which is a steamy, tremendously hot planet with a gigantic atmosphere, that it once was like Earth and probably had life on it, but billions of years ago. And so somehow magically it transformed into this heated inferno, and that all the water just left. But none of this makes any sense for many, many sound scientific reasons. But the question is, number one, why do they insist on putting this out to the public? And I'll tell you, it tends to make the public immune to science. The public just doesn't want to hear anymore about black holes and warp space where everything falls into a black hole and nothing leaves. And then all of a sudden, well, gee, some things are leaving, so now we can measure them. It's just like this week it's one thing, next week it's a bit different story. And the public has really lost interest. And that's why more and more people listen to this show, because they want a real interpretation. They want to have some real science that makes real sense and applies to them. Not this, it's way out there, it's beyond the edge of the universe, and only 10 guys can look through our tremendously expensive telescopes, and only they can understand it, and you're going to get to read about it in the newspaper. And when you do, none of it's going to make any sense, and you're going to have about as much interest in that as, you know, last year's football scores. So, at any rate, let me talk about the planet Venus. And that is a good topic for tonight, because there are so many contradictions involved in our very nearest neighbor. And I've noticed that in the morning sky recently, Venus has been up there. So if you're up early and you look up in the eastern sky and you see that gigantic white dot up there, it's almost like a planet near us, or a moon. That's how big it is. It's just huge in the morning sky. Venus, our nearest neighbor. And now, scientists insist on making these planets all very old. And I'll give a little discussion tonight why this does not have to be the case. And that assumption is creating all kinds of problems in the other sciences. For example, on Earth, our very own Earth, when we talk about mountains, mountain ranges, plate tectonics, the continents drifting around the planet, as supposedly, all of this is in the textbooks. And once people start repeating things, as Lyndon Johnson, that once famous political figure, whether you liked him or not, I certainly did not, but he said that if you repeat something enough times, then other people will start to repeat it, and before long, everybody will think it's true. And of course, he was referring to the Kennedy assassination when he said that. But the point is that in science, too, if you say global warming enough times, if you say the planets are 4.5 billion years old enough times, if you say comets are dirty snowball enough time, then people will start to repeat that. It'll get into textbooks. It'll get in the newspaper. And it'll get into people's heads. And somehow, you then, if you want to bring the real situation, the real information to people, you have to undo all of that programming, all of that mental programming. Then you have to replace it with something that makes sense. And that's very difficult. So that's one of the things I try to do on this show is a lot of people think, well, I'm repeating subjects and then I bring in a new subject. Then I'll go back and I'll go over topics that we've covered before on radio shows. Repetition on the correct science is just as important as repetition on bad science. It has the same effect. So when I talk about Venus, or the fact that comets are not dirty snowballs, or the fact that global warming is a reality, but it's not due to you driving your SUV up and down the roads, but there is another reality to driving your SUV, that is we are polluting this planet to death. And we can't stop that. We can't wait till the year 2030 for the global warming international protocols to catch up and decide that, gee, maybe we should drop our emissions by 15%. No, everybody's going to be dead from breathing in pollutants that are coming out your tailpipe. That's the reality. You can't burn all the oil that we have on Earth. If you do, you will literally burn up all the oxygen and you'll be dead. You won't have any oxygen to breathe. So these are the major topics. These are the ones that you should be reading about in the newspaper. Not that in 2030 a group of international politicians and scientists have decided that if we drop emissions by 15%, maybe that would be a good thing. So what I'm saying is that the information that you get through the standard news media, through standard science, that filtered down to you from the standard journals, is a message. And there's a kind of a convoluted but subtle subliminal message that goes in all of that. And these are the four ones. I call them the axioms of astronomy. There again, people that know my work well are familiar with this. They say that the solar system formed 4.5 billion years ago, that there is no electrical condition in outer space. It's all based on gravity. They say that comets are dirty snowballs, these little poofy things that can't do anything to affect us. And they also say that the universe was formed probably 12 to 13 billion years ago, and that it started in a giant Big Bang. And what I've been telling people is that none of these are true. None of those axioms of astronomy are true at all. And there's good reason to believe that. So let me get back to the concept of Venus. What is Venus? Where did it come from? Most people really don't have a good visual picture of Venus. So that's where I'm going to start. Prior to spacecraft landing on Venus, the American scientists thought that there would be dinosaurs possibly there, because there was a big carbon dioxide shield around Venus, a gigantic atmosphere. And so they thought, well, it should be pretty warm and balmy down there. And in fact, it could be some fern forests and possibly dinosaurs. That was actually the vision of Venus before U.S. spacecraft entered the atmosphere of Venus and saw the true conditions. The Russians were telling the Americans, the Russians had already been there, he said, you're going to be surprised. This isn't anything like you ever imagined. It's a seething hell of hot gases, of sulfuric acid, which rains out of the sky, and the surface so hot it can melt lead. But that's what the Russians told the Americans. But of course, American scientists were too smart for their own good and didn't believe that. So anyway, the American spacecraft finally arrived at Venus. And what do they find? They find the conditions that the Russians told them they would find. And let me describe some of the conditions. The atmosphere of Venus is 100 times denser and more extensive than Earth's atmosphere. Density is related to quantity. So the Venusian atmosphere is gigantic compared to Earth. And that's why it looks so large in the morning sky. It's quite far away. In fact, it's probably not much closer than Mars at its closest approach, but Venus looks very much brighter. And one of the reasons is because it has a tremendous haze layer at the very top of its atmosphere that reflects about 95% of the light that reaches it from the sun. So literally, it's about as bright as the sun for the space that it occupies as you look at it up in the sky. 95% of the sunlight is reflected off the cloud tops of Venus. That's why it looks so bright. And when it is so bright, we're only seeing half of it. If you could get around on the other side of Venus and take a look at it, it would be so bright you couldn't look at the upper atmosphere. That's how bright Venus is. Compare that to Mars, which really doesn't have much of an atmosphere at all. Mars has a very, very thin atmosphere. So what you see when you see Mars, you see that red planet. You see Mars' surface, and it's just a dusty red surface. So that's why you see Mars as a very reddish-orange planet. You don't see the surface of Venus. But at any rate, let's go back to the specifics of Venus. As the American spacecraft dropped down through the atmosphere, they realized there were no winds. There were no crosswinds. There were no winds at the surface. There were no winds of any kind. It was just still and hot. It was raining sulfuric acid out of the clouds. There was no water. The H2 and O, the molecules, the atoms that are in the water molecule, were in very different forms on Venus. And the surface of Venus showed recent volcanic activity all over the surface. When the Magellan spacecraft orbited Venus for about a year and a half and used sounding techniques to map the surface of Venus, after the 1 year, it had completely mapped the surface of Venus. The satellites, the Magellan satellite, still had life in it. When it started mapping Venus for the second time, lo and behold, the surface of Venus had already changed, which means that the surface of Venus is fluid. The mountains would rise up and then just drop back down, kind of like oatmeal in the morning. If you ever watch your cook hot breakfast cereal in the morning, and it goes bloop, 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 like that, you know, that bubbly sound, and it's very thick, and the bubbles break, and then it collapses down into itself. That's what Venus is like on the surface. It is not a friendly place. And that volcanism, that changing of the surface, shows that the heat is emerging from the center of the planet, that the center of the planet is hotter than the outside, just like the bottom of your oatmeal pan or your whatever your breakfast cereal is. It's hotter on the bottom, therefore that heat is trying to escape and come out the surface. That's what Venus is doing. But this was so radically different than what scientists had expected that they started to create all kinds of crazy theories, like the greenhouse effect. Now, this is why I'm bringing this up, because scientists have a stake in all of their theoretical work. If global warming is true, you need a greenhouse to cause that global warming. But here's the contradiction. The scientists knew immediately that Venus had some problems, some theoretical problems. Venus never rotates relative to the sun. It always shines or shows the same face to the sun. Actually, it rotates very slowly, a few hundred day rotation, whereas Earth rotates every 24 hours on its axis. Venus rotates extremely slowly relative to the sun. So basically, it shows its same face to the sun for hundreds of days in a row. So now scientists have very cavalierly introduced what is known as the greenhouse effect on Venus, that sunlight would come in and somehow heat up the atmosphere and then not be able to escape and keep heating up the planet. But the problem is, then the nighttime side of Venus should be cooler. Because, number one, there's no wind, there's no physical mechanism to bring the heat around from the warm sun side of Venus to the cool nighttime side of Venus. And we know on Earth, for example, just take Earth for example, that Earth will drop its temperature between 6 and 20 degrees overnight, just by turning around in just those few hours, 4 to 6 hours, the temperature is already dropping 6 to 20 degrees because the sun is not shining on it. Very simple. So Venus, when they measured the surface temperature of Venus on the day and the night side, they were exactly the same. You now have a theoretical problem. Enter thermodynamics, something I studied when I was studying physics. In thermodynamics, if a hot area is driving energy into a cooler area, there has to be a difference in temperature. In other words, if you open your refrigerator door and you leave it open, the warm room air is going to go into the refrigerator, right? The refrigerator is colder, the warm room air is going to go in there, and it's going to warm things up in your refrigerator. The reason that heat is transferring from your room into the refrigerator is because there's a differential in temperature. And so this is basic physics. It's basic common sense. But on Venus, Venus doesn't obey the laws of physics according to standard science. They've developed a theory called the greenhouse effect, which simply does not explain what you observe there. Even if the greenhouse effect worked on the sunward side of Venus, there's no mechanism to get the heat around to the dark side of Venus. You see what I mean? So Venus has some problems. But in the milieu of trying to pass information off to the public, the standard scientific community bypasses all of these issues and then comes up with something that is so ridiculous, so out of reach of reality, with no verification of any time. This is just pure speculation. They say that Venus, this came out this past week, Venus had oceans and water billions of years ago, and that all the water just left Venus, and now we got to find out why the water left. Well, there's never been a measurement of water being on Venus. There's no real reason to think it was there. But scientists, see what I'm talking about? Scientists in standard scientific communities need to rationalize this idea that planets are billions of years old, so they can use that idea passed on from astronomers in the standard scientific community to then put more misinformation in front of the public. And the real end effect is the public is going, ho-hum, I don't care. I don't want to hear about another billion-year-old concept having to do with a planet. And the public can read into this, that this is pure speculation based on fantasy, and some scientist or group of scientists is getting a paycheck for promoting this. But now let's talk about the reality. What is the situation with Venus? And this has always been a theoretical issue with scientists, that the planets, if let's say that Venus is between us and the sun, that's where Venus and its orbit lie, between us and the sun currently, that's the situation. So if Venus formed after Earth, then how on Earth could it get into that nice stable orbit inside of Earth? And they can't imagine a way that this could happen. And if you assume that all the planets formed 4.5 billion years ago and all formed at the same time, then what you're left with is the need to rationalize every different thing you see in outer space relative to that time frame. So enter Velikovsky, right around the 1950s, said that Venus was a rogue comet, came through the solar system, stripped the atmosphere off of Mars and the oceans. As it proceeded through the solar system, it encountered Earth on two different occasions and then eventually became the planet that we know today, the planet Venus, in its nice, neat orbit inside of Earth. Obviously, in terms of standard science, that makes absolutely no sense at all. Enter my work in the late 1970s, and the idea that comets are not dirty snowballs, but they are an electrical discharge of the solar capacitor. Electrical conditions in the solar system, very different theoretical work, and all of a sudden, here's how Venus would form, and only a number of thousands of years ago. It would be captured by one of the larger planets. This capture process is well known in astronomy, the celestial mechanics. The mechanics of this are well known. So here comes this object, possibly an old chunk of matter from outer space beyond the solar system, and it moves into the solar system. It is captured by Jupiter, and the ancients actually see this happening. That's why they talked about Venus, the goddess, being born of Jupiter, of Zeus. And then it comes in, there's some possibility that it was also encountered Saturn, which is, because Saturn is out there, it is big also. But the point is that it's very difficult to reconstruct all of these possible details, but the theoretical work soundly supports the fact that Venus was not there in ancient times. And here's how it, here's a theoretical proposition for how it came in. It was captured by Jupiter. It became a large comet. It assimilated the gases and the high temperatures due to the heat of formation of this planet forming in the solar system as the ancients on Earth watched it forming. They saw the giant comet in the sky, and it became an integral part of mythology of the Mayans, who came much later, of the Incas and the Aztecs, where Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent of the sky, became the planet Venus. And the legend is handed down to us that Venus, or Quetzalcoatl as it was known, the giant plumed serpent god that ruled the sky for hundreds of years, its heart eventually became the planet Venus. In other words, the comet moved in, circularized its orbit because of the tail drag. There's a scientific principle involved in the plasma discharge comet model. All of this is explained in my books and in videos, and how this process works. So the entire motivation for calling Venus an old planet, or claiming that it had oceans 2 billion years ago, is simply not there, because Venus itself was not there. But you see that standard science has to somehow maintain all of these theories so that they can maintain the axioms of astronomy, one of which is that all the planets formed 4.5 billion years ago. Now we look out into the solar system and find that there are dozens and dozens of objects out there which don't look like they're 4.5 billion years old. Some of them look like they came out of an exploded planet, chunks of matter so densely packed that in very dense metals, for example, that object that hit in the middle of the New Mexico desert and created the large crater a couple miles in diameter, that object was so dense and had so much metal in it, certainly that didn't form from some poofy little dust cloud billions of years ago. It was extremely dense. It probably came from the inner core of either a star or a very dense planet that was blown to pieces one day when something crashed into it. Also, one of the concepts that NASA wants to keep out in the public is that space is pretty much genteel. The planets were always there. Nothing's going to happen. And we won't have any new planets. So at any rate, I just wanted to bring this up in light of the fact that I'm starting to promote my books, DVDs, and lectures again. My work shows how all of these processes work, and you will understand them. And I also want to emphasize for students involved in homeschooling, a lot of people are using my books for homeschooling because they understand their kids are getting a real education, and the education that kids get in the public or the private schools using textbooks is very distorted. It's very unfortunate. But at any rate, once again, and now I'm just going to end this show with a quick comparison of water systems. And this is something actually by popular request, people have called in and asked me, what is the comparison of water systems? Because some people have an inline water filter in their kitchen. It's under the sink, or it's down in the basement, hooked into the water line. Or some people are looking at obtaining some kind of system to filter water. I heard just the other day that Atlanta, Georgia only has a 3-month supply of water in existence right now. Very critical conditions exist around the country. We have droughts in some area, flood in other areas, and whether you're having excessive water or not enough water, water is going to become a huge issue. So let me quick run down the comparisons. City water, typically, and Atlanta is a great example of a city with terrible water, and it historically has had serious problems. People with wells are finding out that sometimes many miles away, pollution is going on and it's seeping into the groundwater. And where they once had a clean well, they're not so sure about that anymore. Also, bottled water is one of the options people are looking at, but there's that ongoing expense, and you can see that you're going to be spending $300-$400 a year for bottled water, and if it runs out, you have to wait, or you have to make a phone call to get more water. In case of emergency, bottled water is not going to do you any good. Your inline water purifying elements, sometimes they crack or the seal breaks and you're not getting anything filtered. It's coming right through that crack because of the high pressure in the line. And so ask yourself this: does your source of fresh water provide you clean drinking water at home for drinking and for cooking? Can it be used when you travel, when you go to even the next town and you want a source of clean water, or you go take the family on vacation? Can it be used for camping and recreation? Out in the, if you go camping, can you take your water filter with you and have clean, fresh water or your bottled water? And in case of an emergency, serious emergency, is your water system going to work for you? And the answer for city water, wells, bottled water, and inline in-house water filter, the answer to all of those is no. Your water source is not going to work for all these various conditions. And plus, you are going to be paying a considerable amount of money for example, the inline house water filter costs around $1,800. Bottled water runs $300-$400 a year. So for home drinking, cooking, for travel, camping and recreation, and emergency, there's one water system that works. That's why I promote it. It's called the Berkey water filter, and I offer the best deal on the planet. The Berkey price is set by the manufacturer, but what I insist is that you get the two extra filters. So you get the big Berkey, it's just two canisters, they sit one on top of the other. You get two filter elements plus two extra filter elements that you will need in case of an emergency. The free Kato WRX 911 emergency shortwave radio that you can use to listen to this show and other shows. And then free shipping to the 50 states. The cost for this, $315, less than what you would pay for bottled water for an entire year. The address, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, Minnesota, 55392. Or the webpage also has this offer described with the picture of the Berkey, jmccsci.com. And for $315, you will have water for home drinking, cooking, travel, camping, recreation, and in case of an emergency. I use mine every day. I use it when I travel. I take it camping with me. And I know that if I left my house in case of an emergency, that would be the one thing I take with me. This has been an interesting show because I'm starting to promote my books again. And I want to encourage people to take a look at these if you're not familiar with them. If you are, look at the webpage because there are offers where you can provide these to friends and dignitaries, etc. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.